Amos Fortune, Free Man, Chapter 3, Boston, 1725 to 1740. Caleb Copeland was not sure what he would say to his wife when he arrived home with no more money for the cloth he had taken with him and a stalwart young Negro boy instead. He need not have feared, for Celia, his wife, had a generous heart. She hastened to open the door when she heard the click of the garden gate. "How did he come by the boy?" she asked. For tall and dark-skinned as the Negro was, he had the build of a boy, and instantly she thought he would have been the age of their son had they not had to wait so long for him to come. "I bought him at the wharf. A ship had just come in, and they were selling the merchandise." "Mr. Copeland!" Celia exclaimed in horror, making her suddenly formal. "Thee knows we are against slavery." Caleb sighed. "Yes, and yet when I saw him standing there, and I knew we needed someone to help in the house, I knew he would have a Christian home with kindly treatment and an opportunity to cultivate his mind. I could not help buying him. But I bought him outright, wife. I did not bid on him." Celia smiled. "He looks a fine, strong boy, and you will give him his freedom." "Yes, in time." Caleb agreed a trifle reluctantly, though in his untamed state, it would not be well to give it him too soon. "You think he would not know how to use it? He is part animal now. What would he do but run wild?" "He looks a good boy to me," Celia remarked. Amos had stood unmoving during their conversation, but his eyes had been taking in every detail of the house behind the open door, and he was not unaware of the small boy and girl who peered out at him from behind their mother's full skirts. "Yes, I do believe he is a good boy," Caleb admitted. "But none of them sell without some fault, and he has a sad one. He cannot speak." "Oh, poor lad," Celia exclaimed. Then she approached him and looked up into his face. "What is thy name, boy?" she asked, as if she would disprove for herself what her husband had said. "His name is Amos," Caleb told her. The boy opened his mouth. "Atmun." Rich and guttural, the sound filled the air, echoing through the house. Then the full lips closed and were silent. "That is the only sound he can make," Caleb exclaimed. "He went cheap for that. Perhaps he will speak when he has no longer anything to fear." Celia turned briskly and went into the house, feeling that she had other things to do than stand talking on her doorstep, even though it was with her husband. "Take the boy to the workroom and show him the trade," she called back, "while I prepare a room for him. Come, Roger. Come, Roxanna," she called to the children, for she had tasks for them. When she rejoined Caleb and the boy, Caleb was standing by the loom, pointing out its operation, while the boy stood behind him, head high, face expressionless. "He doesn't understand anything," Caleb exclaimed, exasperation mounting in his voice as color had to his cheeks. Celia shook her head. "How can he? Poor black lamb. He's heard another tongue all his life. We'll have to teach him." She raised her voice. "Amos," she said, looking at him. He turned at the sound of her voice. She nodded and said the name again, pointing to him. Then she pointed to Caleb, saying his name, and to herself, saying hers. "Amos, come," she said. He made no move, but his dark face looked more bewildered than stoiled. "Amos, come," she repeated, beckoning this time. As if drawn by her gesture, he took a step or two toward her. She nodded vigorously. The beginning of a smile flickered over the boy's lips. Celia looked at her husband. "He will understand in time," she said. "I will teach him as I teach the other children." She bade the boy to come, and like an innocent dog, he followed her out of the room. She led him to a small, plain room off the kitchen. In it was a narrow bed, a chair, a table, all of which meant nothing to the boy. She sat on the chair to show him what to do. He watched her expressionlessly. Then, after a moment, he squatted on the floor and grinned up at her. "Sit," she said slowly, but he made no effort to repeat the word after her. She lay down on the bed and closed her eyes to indicate sleep. Again, he watched her closely, then nodded as he had seen her do. His eyes searched the room and lighted on a woven mat on the floor. Picking up the mat, he folded it carefully in a corner, then curled himself up on it and closed his eyes. "Sleep," she explained. He stood up and nodded again. "Atmun," he said, standing taller as he made the sound. Celia went into the kitchen, and the boy followed her. She sat at the long table and gestured to him to do the same. Awkwardly, he did so. She put a pewter plate and fork before him, but when she offered him some food, the boy took it in his hands and thrust it into his mouth. That night, Celia and Caleb Copeland sat together by the fire talking. The children were tucked in their bed, and the Negro boy was curled on the mat in the corner of his room. "It will take time, Caleb, but he is a good boy. He will learn. I think he will even learn to speak. But he can make no sound, save that one." "That is not a sound, Caleb. It is a word. Something he has brought with him from Africa. He will not give it up until he can replace it with something of equal meaning." "How does he know that?" She shook her head. There were some questions that even a good wife could not answer. It was slow, but Amos learned as a child to do the things about the house that he was shown to do, to help with the carding and spinning, then, at last, to be trusted with the work at the loom. Gradually, he relinquished his African ways and sat on a chair, slept on a bed, ate with a knife and fork instead of his fingers. He accustomed himself to trousers and shirt, even seeking a touch of finery in a bird's feather stuck in his hat. He went to meeting first day, sitting in the pew with the Copeland family. He attended the school for children, which Mistress Copeland held daily in her spacious kitchen. Roger and Roxanna had been the first pupils, but their mother had made welcome the Negro children who had been born in nearby homes, and she taught them all with zeal and devotion. Amos learned to read and write and cipher, but still he did not speak easily, though the expression in his eyes and the mobility of his face spoke for him. From the start, he had loved the two Copeland children, but it was the little girl who seemed to understand him in a special way. Often they sat on the hearth together, Roxanna reading to him from the Bible, since that was the book they all read from in their lessons. Amos would listen closely, following with his eyes her finger as it moved across the page. One day Celia was kneading dough in a corner of the kitchen, not so much listening to as aware of the prattling voice of Roxanna as she read an answering silence of the Negro. "You can see for yourself, Amos," the little girl was saying, "the words my father read this morning. Unto him that loved us and washed us from our sins in his own blood and hath made us kings and priests unto God." She laughed, a little ripple of childish pleasure. "Isn't that nice, Amos? You can be a king and I'll be a priest." There was a silence as Amos bent over the book to see the words. His dark finger traced them, and his eyes brought their meaning to him. Roxanna went on reading, but Amos, who loved the sound of words, for once was not listening. He had raised his head and was looking before him into a black cavern of the fireplace. "Then I am a king," he said slowly, and the syllables came between his lips, rich and low. Roxanna looked at him. "You can talk just like me, can't you, Amos?" He nodded, while he repeated to himself, "I am a king." "Unto God," the children reminded. Amos nodded again. Then he looked down at the book open in Roxanna's lap. Putting his finger beside hers on the page, he traced the next words and read them aloud together. "Behold, he cometh with clouds, and every eye shall see him." The two voices went on murmuringly, slowly, sounding out the words. They read them all, no matter how unpronounceable or meaningless, gaining intelligence from them, of one kind to the child, of another to the African. Celia kneading her dough quietly, as if unaware of the scene on the hearth, but she thought of it often during the days that followed, for the strange sound, Atmun, no longer came from Amos' lips. And slowly, haltingly, experimentally, he began to join in their conversation. Except for the depth in his voice and the clipped syllabic sound, it was like the voice of Caleb Copeland. Amos was pleased he could communicate with those near him, and he spent more time than ever reading the Bible. I am a king. His lips shaped the phrase as lovingly as they once had his name of Atmun. Amos grew from tall, lean boy to strong, muscular manhood under the Copeland roof. For 15 years, he shared all the life of the household. Roger learned the weaving trade, married and moved to Acton to establish himself there as a weaver. Roxanna grew to be as tall as her father, as skilled in the work of the house as her mother. Amos thought of himself as one of them, and whenever Caleb spoke to him of manumission, he said he did not want it yet. There were many Negroes known to Amos who had been given freedom and who had found it an even harder lot to bear than servitude. There were those of his friends who so longed for freedom that they plotted among themselves to gain their release, and failing to achieve it, became sullen and bitter. And there were some who ran away, but more often than not, they were captured and brought back. Amos's heart ached for his African friends who were ill-treated, beaten, forced to marry against their will, or kept from marrying those they loved. For them, there seemed little future and no past. Since all that had been theirs had become clouded in their minds, the white man's world, with its toil and indignities, was nothing they wanted to call their own. They looked to Amos as more than a welcome friend, for he remembered the land from which they had all come, and he would tell them stories of it and sing them songs about it. Listening to him, they thought they remembered the past too, and the present did not seem so barren. But though they looked upon him as a leader, he would not join in their plotting against their white masters or in their plans for escape. "Wait for the free day," he would urge them, "for it is coming." It had come in the Copeland household. It was spreading throughout the Quaker community. Soon there would not be a member of Society of Friends who would own a slave. "Servants, be obedient to them that are your masters," was the admonition in most households. But it was not so with the Copelands. Amos had been introduced to Christianity through another text. "Bear ye one another's burdens," were the words most often heard in the household to which Amos had allied himself heart and soul, and with all the strength of his powerful body. "But don't you want your freedom?" Celia would ask Amos time and again. "No," he would reply, "not yet a while." He wanted to tell her the reason lying back in his mind, but words would not come to him to convey the haze of memory. Amos knew many a slave who had been freed, given his article of manumission by a grateful master in return for his years of faithful service, and given the tools of a trade so he might set himself up and be one of the way to a self-respecting life. But Amos had deep within him the inheritance of the Atmunshi, of looking up to someone older and wiser as a protector. The white man in the person of Caleb Copeland had become such a protector to Amos. Amos looked to him with reverence and loyalty. He did not want his life to be apart from Caleb's in any way. As a working member of the Copeland family, Amos had his own dignity. Apart, he would endure the separateness he knew many of his African friends endured because of their lack of status in the white man's world. Educated by the white man until they had become well-trained and articulate, baptized in his faith, they still were kept apart. African corners were assigned to them in the churches and separate plots in the graveyards. So they tendered to and from their own groups where they knew they would always be welcome. The houses of the free Negroes become meeting places for all the Negroes in community. There they would gather, telling their stories and singing the songs whose melodies went further back than memory. Sad songs they were for the most part, yet hope filtered through them like the sun through a dark day's clouds, as fervently they sang of the joys that awaited them in another world. After he had learned to read, Amos spent much of his time poring over the Boston newsletter, reading with special interest of the arrival of ships at the wharf and the discharge of their cargoes. When Caleb Copeland had cloth to be delivered, he granted Amos' wish to let him take it on a day when a sailing ship had arrived. Amos liked the excitement of the harbor. The air was alive with activity and echoed with shouts as outgoing ships were loaded with rum and fish, textiles, and lumber. Incoming ships were unloaded of molasses, sugar, cotton, and Negroes. Of these, there were never a great number, for the bulk had already been sold at high prices in the plantation colonies. The men and the women lined up on the deck or standing in chains on the wharf, Amos scarcely bothered to look at. But to the children he gave his full attention. Almost always there were one or two, sometimes several, for certain ships' masters were renowned for bringing in boys and girls to be trained early as personal servants. High in hopes, Amos went watching the little ones, frightened or rebellious, as they were torn from their own people and stood up on the block. Amos longed to say a word of comfort or cheer to them. Yet he knew the words of the Admonshi remained with him, except his own, none of the words, except his name. Eyes met eyes while he wondered if anything in his could answer the questions in those that looked at him. Yet with the cargo discharged and the auctioneer calling for bids, Amos would turn sadly away. No small dark girl with a smile like the first rays of dawn and a useless leg that she must drag behind her all her life had come off the ship. He turned home again, remembering, wondering, reaching out to touch the head of a thin little black boy to ease the ache of his own heart. Amos' friends used to call him Mr. Fortunatus because he had had good fortune in being well-treated, and Amos responded readily to the name. His friends could use it if they liked, he thought, for they were not apt ever to see his back bearing the marks still of the baiting he had had in the early days. He would not let himself forget those days because he wanted to remember much else connected with them. In time, the name was formalized to Fortune, and Amos knew that when the day came and he was Mr. Copeland's Amos no longer, he would stand before the world as Amos Fortune, free man. But Caleb Copeland died before he had given his devoted slave his certificate of freedom. A week later, a notice appeared in the Gazette. To be sold at public venue on Tuesday, 22nd April, 1740, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, at the house where the late Mr. Caleb Copeland lived, one weaver's loom and sundry apparatuses, two bedsteads, chairs, tables, a turkey carpet, various articles of tin, and pewterware, and one likely Negro, in good health, 30 years of age. Celia had not wanted it to be so. She and Roxana had wept at the thought of parting with their possessions and their faithful friend. But there were debts to be paid, and Amos had comforted them with his assurance of right outcome for them all. He had not dwelt for half of his lifetime in a Christian household without absorbing trust and confidence. He did not care where he was taken, he told Celia, as long as it was not far inland. But he could not give her his reason, and she thought it was because he loved the smell of the sea that he went to it so often. Amos wanted to be able to spend the free time allowed him in haunting the wharfs when ships came in. Though fewer and fewer Negroes were being brought to New England, he would keep looking until he found the object he was searching. A girl of 12 rainy seasons, a girl who would not bring much at public auction because of the limp with which she walked. Perhaps she would go for a little that he would himself buy her. Thinking of that, Amos would count his hoard of savings, waiting for the day. It was hard to remember her, but he still could make himself see the African village just as it was on that last night, his father, and the small, frail Athmun, the wooden flutes and the beating drums and the immemorial chant. The sun stood still over Africa. It was only in America that it moved. The day of the venue came, and the household articles and weaver's tools sold well. Amos sat on the bench on which he had sat for all of his lessons until it was old out from under him. Then he stood by the auctioneer. It amused him to hear himself described, and he grinned broadly as he listened to the auctioneer's words. This likely fellow, strong, healthy, thoroughly domesticated, speaks English better than I do. He's a weaver by association with Mr. Caleb Copeland, but he's smart enough to learn any trade. He's a rare offering these days. What will you give me for him? 10 pounds, a voice spoke out from the crowd. The auctioneer laughed. He would cost more than that on the Gold Coast. This isn't the raw, untamed product. my good man, but something highly civilized. The bids cracked out, mounting up. Amys even bid once on himself, and a roar of laughter went up from the crowd. When the bidding went over 50, Amos withdrew. He could not spend that much and haven't anything left for Ethmun when she came. The bidding stopped at 62, and the last sum was offered by the man who had made the first bid. Sold to Mr. Ichabod Richardson, tanner of Woburn. The auctioneer bellowed out, "One black slave by name Amos Fortune, for the consideration of 62 pounds sterling." A half hour later, Amos rode off with Mr. Richardson in his wagon. He had said goodbye to the house that had been his home for the first 15 years in America. He had promised to write to Mrs. Copeland, and he had said he would not forget her. He did not know what lay before him, but he had the omen of his name to fall back on. He had had good fortune. He would have it again. Ichabod Richardson leveled his eyes on his black companion, erect of black. Ichabod Richardson leveled his eyes on his black companion, erect of back, head high. "I think I know a good thing when I see it," he said. Then he chuckled to the clucked to the horse, and they clattered over the road on their way to Woburn.